Well, we do carry classical music on a regular basis here at WFERLP South Royalton. In fact, if you're listening in live time, show live from the studio, Concert Music Safari with Tom Healy from 2 to 4. But it's just after 11. Listening to a little bit of Antonio Vivaldi, Winter. Indeed, winter in all its masquerades is here. The rain followed by the freeze, followed by some snow, etc. Be careful out there. It's taken from the Four Seasons. Green Scene is here. We'll be talking about the Telephone Gap Forestry Plan and a whole lot more. Todd and Henry with you for the next hour. Green Scene is brought to you by the White River Land Collaborative, Solar Fest, First Branch Coffee Company, Wit and Grit Restaurant up in Randolph, Vermont, Soliflect, Bale, Royal Trail Works, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, and the First Branch Coffee Company. We really appreciate all these local and regional supporters of all-volunteer, non-commercial community radio here at WFBR-LP, South Royalton, Vermont. Well, good morning, Henry. Welcome back to Green Scene.
Good morning. The sun has started to show its head in Burlington.
Yeah, we haven't seen it in a while.
We have had all of our snow melt off up here.
All of it. Wow. Well, we haven't had that happen here. Fortunately, for those who like to play in the snow, no, there's snowpack is still pretty good, but it got watered down and now it's getting pretty crusty.
Time to get your sleds out and go down through the woods and see if you can kill yourself.
No, I do.
I did that when I was a kid. We sledded in the woods on a crust that was good enough so that you never broke through. Ooh. It was very fast and extremely hazardous.
Well, that sounds like you, no matter what age, the very hazardous part often accompanies your bio, Henry.
But you gotta enjoy life, you know. You gotta go for it.
Yeah, good. You've made it this far. And it obviously has worked for you.
I mean, you know, if you don't ever want to get yourself in trouble, you could just deploy your airbags in your car before you ever drove away.
Yeah, I will add a safety note though, and I didn't get around to giving the ski report, and the ski report is not as good today as it was a couple of days ago. But several years ago, I ski quite a bit without a helmet. So we're talking maybe a decade ago, and I was skiing in the trees at Mad River Glen, and I had a fall. I didn't hit a tree, but I had a fall and was sliding downhill backwards, not even knowing what was coming up. And I stopped with my head 2 inches from a pretty sturdy tree. And it could have come out. There's no give.
Those trees don't move when you hit them.
No, they don't. And so in less than a week, I did have a helmet. So whenever I'm at that type of skiing, I always wear my helmet. I'm not as big a risk taker as you are, Henry.
I bike a fair amount, and I always wear a helmet on a bike. And yep. If I've got anyone going out with me, I make sure I've supplied them a helmet as well.
That's good, Henry. You know, we've just confirmed our date for next summer's Pedal Power to the People event. Maybe you could come participate. Mark it on your calendar, August 23rd. Yep.
Ah. All right.
You got it.
August 23rd.
August 23rd. It'll be in Tunbridge, right out of Tunbridge. Yep. It's not that far from your house. But I digress. So we are moving through some weird, weird winter, which I'm seeing a trend that I hope doesn't continue. Last winter, for people that were paying attention, knew that often precipitation events, it might have been really cold for several days, and then all of a sudden when precipitation was coming, the thermometer would go up by 15, 20 degrees, and it would come down in the form of rain, which is due to happen again in a few days from now. We just, of course, had a major rain event. Were there any flood warnings up your way?
There were flood warnings, but we didn't see flood here. Maybe, you know, the rivers probably came up, the Lamoille and the Winooski.
Yes.
But I haven't been following the morning news to see whether Barrie and Mount Pilliar got flooded out again.
Yeah, we know we get some reports log only when they don't contain our immediate area here in Windsor and Orange County. But I didn't see as many flood warnings as I thought. I think I saw one in Addison County. Rutland had one last night. But I think maybe we got lucky this time around as far as the flooding. That's my sense.
You know, if you go back to the 27 flood, which took out something like 30% of all the bridges in the state of Vermont, mm-hmm. That was the kind of conditions that we're tending to get right now, where you get some snow and then some rain on top and then saturated ground, and then it freezes up. And then when the rain comes, there is no place for it to go but to run off because the ground is frozen, is not absorbing the rain, and enough of the snow is gone, so it's no longer acting like a sponge. And that's what took all the bridges out, or so many of the bridges out in the state of Vermont in 27. And it was sort of a day and a half of rain. After having the conditions set up right. So there was no place except for downhill for that water to go.
Yeah, well, hopefully we're not going to...
I suspect that quite separate of bigger rain events, we will see that kind of condition happen year after year in Vermont, because we certainly are getting winter thaws and far more rain events during the wintertime.
You know, and another thing that accompanies that type of fast warm-ups and the ground not really freezing up solid down deep is the mud season. We had multiple mud seasons last year, and that looks like it could be on the back road forecast for this year. So just giving people a heads up. They already know about this, but just, a safety reminder.
So how much mud did you have just in this last little thaw? Did you see a lot of mud?
No.
My daughter reported from Stowe. I was going to go visit her today to help her put her Christmas tree up. And she said, I don't think you can get up my driveway. Her husband said he almost couldn't get his Subaru four-wheel drive up the driveway a day ago during that thaw.
Oh, and it was primarily because of mud, not because of slushy snow that was just really damp?
Well, it was I don't know the gory details, but I think it was definitely thaw that was causing it, whether it was, snow and ice mixed with dirt and mud, I don't know.
Well, as far as what I've witnessed, and I'm glad that it got cold overnight because there was kind of some slush, but as far as the surface below what didn't get plowed off, so in other words, you still have some slushy snow on top of semi-frozen road, there were not deep ruts of mud, and I was driving around a bit yesterday during the rain, and things firmed up a little bit. So, no, mud, this is not yet. We haven't had our first muddy day down here. So, knock on wood, it's supposed to be pretty cold the next couple of days, and we'll take it from there.
Yes. Cold is coming back.
Yep. So, we've got, tell us about our guests coming up in about 10 minutes or so.
Yeah. So, we've got, we're covering the telephone gap, as you mentioned. So, that's a section of pretty mature woods that was on the agenda to be logged off, and it's had pushback over several years trying to get the Forest Service to change their approach to this. And so we're going to be talking to Tim Duclos of the Audubon Society, who is one of the people who worked on getting that forestry plan changed. We had interviewed standing trees.
Yes. Zach Porter. Yeah. And a couple of other people. Yeah.
About it, I went to the, or we both went to that rally that maybe 3 years ago at the ranger station near the telephone gap. And we were scheduled today to have Jamie Field of the Natural Resources Defense Council, who is a restoration ecologist and a lawyer, and was involved in pressing the agencies to get the management of this right. So he had a death in the family, so we moved over to Tim Duclos. So that's our grand rambling history of making Green Zine happen today.
Yeah, you know what I like about the fact that we're revisiting Telephone Gap, and we've been doing this show for nearly 12 years, is that certain subjects, certain activist things keep coming around again. Sometimes in a way, you know, the natural gas pipeline on the western part of the state. We're going to be talking about the bird count, which comes around about this time of year. That these are ongoing stories. A little bit later in the show, we're going to reference a fine book called What If We Get It Right, written by Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson. And I'm going to particularly delve into the press coverage and someone who's followed climate change matters in the mainstream media for quite a bit. And one of the points that she makes is that a lot of the news cycle is driven by kind of one time, like, oh, that's yesterday's news, rather than ongoing issues like climate change. It's going to be an ongoing issue for centuries. It's not all over tomorrow or next week because you put the paper down or you turned off the TV. And so some of these subjects that we've covered here in the state of Vermont that keep coming around and need to be addressed, and you know, people need to get active with their legislators or with nonprofit groups. I think that's a good sign, Henry. Yep.
I do too. And even though we're sort of sledding uphill with the direction that the wind's going,
yeah,
or the political climate, the political winds of not just the United States but of the world. But I think there's a lot of hope out there, and I think it's really a question of not being numb, but becoming engaged and curious. I saw a marvelous podcast, listened to a podcast yesterday that was commenting that having that level of curiosity is what moves us forward and gives us new hope when we just turn off because it's too daunting, then good things stop happening.
Yeah.
So,
all right. Well,
so we'll keep being curious and do our best to put things out there.
Right.
Let's get into that bird count. Maybe the bird notes.
I've got it lined up here. Let's listen, and then you can give some details, which I think you've posted at our notes section at WFVR.org about how you can get involved locally. But yeah, let's see what the bird note folks have to say.
.org.
This is bird note.
Six American goldfinch.
Yellow-rumped warbler.
Bald eagle.
Oh, very nice.
Think about joining this year's annual Christmas bird count. Birder Gene Hun compiles the results for just one of 2,000 groups worldwide that participate in the count.
So we have data that goes back to 1908, and it's nearly complete. That allows you to track the changing fortunes of many of the local birds. It's not precisely accurate from a point of view of a laboratory scientist. It's citizen science. So the people who report the data are amateur bird watchers for almost entirely. And the parties that do the observing in a particular area are typically led by somebody who's very knowledgeable. But anybody can join in, so you get that sort of camaraderie that comes from people of all different levels of expertise participating together. All of these counts then together provide a snapshot of the distribution of birds at the beginning of the winter season.
Here's just one sample of what we're learning from this resource. The winter ranges of many different species of birds in North America have been shifting north about 35 miles over the last 10 or 20 years. It's not a perfect curve, but when you look at the information from across the country, it's clear that global climate change is having an impact on at least certain species of birds. To join the Christmas bird count in your area, begin at our website, birdnote.org.
Yeah. Henry, I'm sure you probably have noticed over the last few years some species that maybe 10, 20 years ago you didn't see in the area.
Well, and I get it clouded because I moved to the banana belt up there.
Oh, that's true.
And so I see things that, I mean, there's just cardinals everywhere here. And up in my place in Tunbridge, I never see a cardinal. So just a reference, in the notes, there is a book, The Forest Journey, The Role of Trees in the Fate of Civilization. And it's a book by John Perrin and published by, or republished, I would say, is probably what's happened, by Patagonia. It's a beautiful book. And there's a section at the end when talking about the value of older forests, and a link back to migratory birds and forest health. A major study of plants, birds, and insects in tropical in the tropics conclude that only old growth forests are capable of maintaining a substantial proportion of biodiversity. And it goes on to say that birds have an effect on pollinating. The birds and the old growth forest help slow things like Lyme disease, and that currently, mostly because of what we're doing to forests, and about 29% of the abundance of birds has disappeared since 1970. And this bird counts that there are notes as to a local person in Randolph and someone in Plainfield who you can contact to help with the bird count, helps bring science to that. It makes it so that those numbers are on the ground, and it's fun to do as well. So join the bird count.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, there's a local conservation commission that during their monthly meetings, they have a section where people, you know, bring up observations of wildlife and plants that have happened since the previous meeting. And apparently that's one of the more popular parts of that conservation commission meeting. So keeping citizen scientists out there and providing data is very helpful. And also, as you say, a lot of fun.
Yeah. So I will go and get Tim Duclos from the Audubon Society to talk about the uphill battle that we think has been won to get a change in management of our forests.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward. We just had, as you probably heard, Henry, Amtrak just went by, and while you're getting a hold of Tim, I have an Amtrak update for our train riders here. We'll be back just shortly with Henry and Tim. I'm going to bring Henry down in the mix. Yeah, this press release just came out in the last few days. I'm someone who has ridden a lot of Amtrak routes over the years, do not fly anymore, and we had a guest actually on the air, it was a guest on the air who categorically said that they decided about 10 years ago they were in a position where they were expected to fly to conferences around the world, and they just decided, no, can't do that anymore. But this is good news for those who support train travel and other forms of travel. Amtrak has reached a historic milestone, carrying 32.8 million passengers in the fiscal year of 2024. That is a 15% increase from the previous fiscal year when it carried nearly 28.6 miles, according to an Amtrak press release. In fact, according to the head guy there, this record ridership shows that travelers throughout the U.S. want efficient travel options, and we are committed to meeting that demand, said Stephen Gardner, the CEO of Amtrak. Their goal is to double its ridership. That's a big ask. Double it to 66 million passengers by the year 2040. Let's see if we can beat that goal. As any of you has followed the financial condition of Amtrak for decades, it hasn't been a good one. They have struggled to financially recover after the pandemic disturbed usual ridership patterns. Gardner predicted it would take at least 5 years for the company to break even after its initial losses in 2020. When it comes to infrastructure, the rail service has invested $4.5 billion into its most extensive infrastructure and fleet transformation to date. Additionally, Amtrak received more than $10 billion in competitive federal grant funds to support current and future building projects. And I think in a separate story, they are developing some new, more efficient cars. They will still have diesel engines, but be much more efficient. And I forget, I think it might have been a 75% decrease in greenhouse gas emissions from rail. When these new cars go online, they're expected to roll out not in 2025, but in 2026. So some good news out there on the rails, as we listened to just a couple minutes ago, the southbound Vermonter heading down the road. In fact, I know one of our programmers is down there at Penn Station, just about to get on the northbound Vermonter. Hey, let's check in with Henry, see if he's back with us. Are you there, Henry?
I am, and I have Tim Duclos of the Audubon Society on the line. So, Tim, welcome to Green Scene.
Hey, Henry, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great. It's nice to have this segue between we just talked about the upcoming Christmas bird count, to have somebody from Audubon here, but also someone who's knowledgeable about the Telephone Gap Green Mountain National Forest Project.
Yeah. So, Tim, maybe just give us a very brief introduction to what's gotten you into doing the work that you do, because you're up to your eyeballs in this, I think.
That's the job. Yes. So I am. I'm an ecologist with Audubon Vermont, which is a state chapter of the Greater National Audubon Society. I lead with my colleagues here in Vermont, our small team. I lead our healthy forest work, and specifically I work with forest landowners, private landowners, as well as municipalities, state federal agencies, to think about how we can manage our forests in Vermont for the benefit of birds, as well as an extension, biodiversity, climate change resiliency, and now a bit of carbon sequestration storage and whatnot. Yeah,
so that leads us right into the subject of, well, why are forests important anyway? What are the services that forests do, and what happens when we don't have forests, when the forests are goofed up? And I spend some time every year out in the Pacific Northwest looking at the clear-cut practices out there and the monocultures. And I spent a lot of time this spring and summer in the White Mountain National Forest. And again, they were growing very even age stands and clear cutting them, and I was amazed at the lack of birds and animals in there. Fill us in on that, kind of what should forests be doing for us?
Yeah, you're speaking my language already. So from my perspective, forests, As they directly relate to birds, the forests that we have here in the Northeast actually host some of the greatest concentrations of breeding birds in the summertime. Like, if you look at the breeding bird survey data or data from surveys like the Christmas bird count, you see that we have more species, more numbers of those birds here in the northern forest in the northeastern U.S. than anywhere else in the country. And our forests, which dominate over 80% of Vermont, are where these birds come to breed, it's these forests that sustain our birds. Birds, greater biodiversity, from all the plants and animals and organisms that live in our forest. In their own right, they're important, but also important from a perspective of, you know, human health and wellness. You know, it's important that we have these spaces for us to be able to go out and experience nature. You know, we have various uses of the forest and the biodiversity that exists in the forest, from foraging to hunting to fishing. Those are more consumptive uses. Our forests also, you know, as they grow, they pull carbon out of the atmosphere and store it in their you know, in their plant tissue, in their wood. So they're carbon sinks, which helps address climate change. Our forests filter our air. They slow down our water, so they address flood risks and vulnerabilities. I could go on and on about the benefits of forests here in the Northeast.
Hey, can I just jump in and ask a comparison question? So we are, fortunately, a heavily forested state, as you said, 80%. How does that stack up with other states of the 50? Is that like one of the highest numbers, or what would another heavily forested state be?
Yeah, I'll say up front that I most centrally focus on the northeastern U.S., but Vermont has comparable amounts of forest to New Hampshire, Maine. Maine, I think, has a bit more forest than us. Vermont has, I dare say, a little less forest than Connecticut. Massachusetts, New York has lots of forest. On average, Vermont fits with our surrounding states in terms of how much forest we have.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I remember from William Momau's discussion with us that he was saying that the spine of the Green Mountains and the southern area of Vermont have some of the highest carbon density woods of New England. If you go to Maine, there's lots of trees there, but they're all very young trees and don't have a lot of stored carbon the way the Vermont forests do. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, our the spine of the Green Mountains, you know, we've got tremendous diversity in terms of the forest types, the age and conditions of forests from the valley floors up to the mountaintops. In our highest elevation areas and on our steepest slopes in our mountains in Vermont, that is where you do find true existing old growth forests that remain. Only about half of 1% of Vermont's existing forests are true old growth forests, meaning they existed before, you know, European settlement. They haven't been cut. And it's in these areas where we see a lot of different forest types, variety of different, you know, aging conditions, where we do see, especially in the mountains, where it's very densely forested, some of our greatest carbon storage. Yes.
So do you see also in those same areas, do you see a big increase in birds and animals and butterflies and damselflies and et cetera? Do they go hand in hand?
Well, as a scientist, we love to joke and say it always depends. But in general, yes. I mean, forests that are highly complex, meaning they've got a lot of different sizes of trees, ages of trees, different species of trees, those complex forests, which tend to be some of our older forests, they do tend to store more carbon than other, let's say, on the other end of the spectrum, like really young forests, you know. Although young forests on the other side of the coin sequester carbon faster than some of our oldest forests, which is a very interesting dynamic there that plays into this. But where we do see carbon-rich forests, in our most complex forests, we do see the greatest diversity of bird species in general, but it's much more complicated than just that too.
Yeah. So I put in the notes a Forest Journey, The Role of Trees in the Fate of Civilization by John Barron. And in the summing up at the end of the book, he has a heading, Forest Temperature Control and Water Supply. And then in that it says, rainfall and runoff data obtained in the study from Melbourne, this is Melbourne, Australia, for example, showed that water yield correlates directly with the age of the forest, which I thought was pretty interesting, that that the forests were really responsible for generating the rainfall and for being the sponge that that meters out water to our cities and to our civilization. I don't know if that's, I mean, in Vermont, we're so blessed with water that it isn't really, it may not be on our front burner.
Well, if anything, we're seeing too much water, right, sometimes with these extreme events. And, yeah, whether it's, you know, water filtration, water storage, or, you know, temperature regulation, you know, the temperature of the forest floor and whatnot. Again, in these complex forest conditions, which I will note that it's not always about age, and that's also a part of this, and specifically also just, you know, thinking about managing for forest complexity. You know, regardless of age in and of itself, highly complex forests do kind of manage climate change effects better than even age forests, younger forests especially.
So describe to us what the National Forest was doing for management, and then what we are talking them into, what change we're talking them into, and what the implications of that might be.
Yeah, so I think what brings us together today is talking about the recent decision released by the U.S. Forest Service, Green Mountain National Forest, regarding the management, proposed management of the Telephone Gap project area just north of Rutland. Essentially, this is a project focused on how the Forest Service is going to manage about 12,000 acres of land. And as I have really focused on in my work with Audubon, we've taken part in the NEPA process, the public comment periods that have been open twice now over the last 2 years, where the public can review in full transparency of what the Forest Service is proposing in terms of forest management and other types of uses of that area, and provide, you know, raise concerns, provide input on what they should be thinking about or what they could do differently. And so Audubon Vermont, with the Vermont, in partnership with the Vermont Natural Resources Council and in partnership with Dr. William Keaton at UVM, so preeminent forest expert in forest ecologists in this area, we looked through what the Forest Service proposed in terms of management, and then we confronted that with the state of affairs among the conservation community, the science community, in terms of, you know, is this going to impact the forest in a negative way, you know, based upon the science, based upon, you know, Agency of Natural Resources, Vermont Conservation Design, the roadmap that our natural resource professionals follow in cohesively advancing conservation goals in the state. And what we saw in there that we provided comments on was that we were hoping to see more focus on the enhancement of old forest conditions, let's call them like late, not to get technical, late seral forests, like kind of older forests, where those forests are heavily impacted, but also protect forests that do exhibit old forest conditions, protect forests that have been designated by the state of Vermont as old growth forest. And outside of those two areas where the forest is most heavily impacted, and silvicultural science suggests that we best hit the reset button on those areas, that's where we really focus the more intensive management. But overall, really here, we push the Forest Service to think about applying the most current science and principles of what we call ecological silviculture so as to prioritize the enhancement of these older forest conditions, much in the way that we work with landowners across the state to see this happen.
Am I remembering correctly that early on in this process, as far as public input going back 2 or 3 years ago, that some of the data and metrics being considered by the National Forest Service were sort of from the early 2000s, maybe up to 2010, and were not really as current as I think some of the groups that you've been working with were providing? Is that correct, or...
Yeah, so it's, you know, we're working with a lot of different data from different time periods, mm-hmm. but what we saw proposed was based off of inventory data that had been taken, you know, previous to this, you know, several years ago, a while back. But also, most importantly, looking at how we... it gets really complicated here, but basically the Forest Service has inventory data that they've gathered on the forest over the years, and it's with that that you can sit at a desk and look at the numbers, and you can remotely kind of identify, screen out areas where this might be old forest based upon these criteria, these thresholds that we have proposed across the region. And here we've pushed the Forest Service to go a bit further and go back out into these stands, into these forests, and reevaluate on the ground now these forest conditions using the most up-to-date measures of old growth forests that we know. And we've seen that. So we've seen over the last year, the Forest Service has reevaluated these stands based upon the criteria that we provided them. And it's as a function of that that they actually reduced the amount of harvest areas that they're proposing so as to preserve the old forest that they did find using the measures we provided.
Yeah, so this is maybe we've just found the tip of the iceberg in this, in this problem. My sense from the commentaries I'm seeing is that the Forest Service has a very detailed process for coming up with forestry plans that take years to develop, and they are. But you know, with President Biden in office, he asked all agencies to look at the work they're doing and try to bring in the climate perspective into mm-hmm. what they're doing. And I'm not aware that played much of a role in the development of the previous forest plans. Am I painting them with a tarred brush? I shouldn't.
Well, I can speak to what I see in the current plan and where we're at now. And I can say that, you know, I appreciate the effort on part of the Forest Service to do their best to try to region-wide and forest-specific try to understand, you know, how do we quantify and measure these old forest conditions. Mm-hmm. To ensure that we are protecting them and we're doing no harm first. And what I see here with the changes we've seen as a result of public input over the last 2 years for Telephone Gap is we do see a much more conservative approach to management that prioritizes the application of, again, ecological silviculture, which really seeks to emulate the natural processes that develop these old forest conditions. And it's these old forest conditions that we need so as to best address climate change vulnerability. You know, the complexity of these forests, really, they sequester more carbon, they store more carbon while they're sequestering more carbon, and they're more resilient to climate change. And so we know that we don't, like I mentioned, we only have about a half of 1% of true old growth forests remaining in Vermont. Our forests very much are, I've heard some people describe them as teenage forests. They're you know, on the spectrum of the millennia in which it takes to develop a forest over the last 160, 70 years, our forests have recovered, but they're not the old growth forests that are truly resilient to climate change. And I see through the application of more ecological focused forest management here that the Forest Service is trying to get the forest to that place where it is going to be more resilient to climate change and sequester, store more carbon.
So as citizens, and much of the, I guess, even though there is a lot of national forest in the state of Vermont, most of our forest is still in private ownership, if I'm not mistaken. So how do we get people to manage their own personal stands in a thoughtful way, in a way that that attempts to balance paying taxes and the ecological long-term benefit of the forest and environment through their management?
Yeah, call up your county forester, your you know, state agency, the Forest Parks and Recreation. You know, you can contact your county forester, and they will provide you with all the resources with which to find a forester. We do have licensed foresters here in Vermont. We're fortunate in that way. And we also have the current use program in Vermont, which is a tax abatement program that incentivizes landowners through a tax break to maintain their forests and to work with qualified forestry professionals to manage their forests. And that's where I would start. Audubon Vermont, the work I do there to support landowners, you can check out our website, audubonvermont.org, or just Google us. You can connect with me, Tim Duclos, there, and I can set you up with one of our partners or myself. I go out and I meet with landowners and provide them with input and resources to think about these things. Vermont Natural Resources Council, Vermont Woodlands Association, Vermont Coverts. There's a lot of partners here, a lot of conservation organizations here in the Vermont providing resources for landowners to do all of this on their land.
How much variation is there from one licensed forester to another in whether they're tuned into creating that kind of diversity, like we've had someone on to talk about coverts before a number of years ago. We need to revisit that one maybe, which is all about making something that has lots of different animals and activity going on in it a real thriving ecosystem. How do you sort foresters to know which ones are on top of this and which ones aren't?
Well, again, that's a conversation that can be bore out in a conversation with your county forester, because everybody's got a reputation, especially in a place like Vermont, and they'll be honest with you. So they'll talk with you about your values and find a forester that aligns with those values. Audubon Vermont, I am developing and leading a forester training and endorsement program that works to do exactly that, to impart these principles, specifically thinking about the benefits to birds, but really, you know, imparting on foresters the knowledge of how to work with landowners to manage their forests with birds in mind. We have 7 foresters right now endorsed in the state of Vermont. We have dozens that have taken our training, so we're building that up. But, you know, you look at, like, the Vermont Woodlands Association, they've got a forester accreditation program. They've got foresters that have, you know, checked all these boxes on the just additional qualifications that they have, you know, related to just beyond licensure. And so those alone are two, those are a couple of ways in which to start to find the right forester for you.
Hey, before we let you go, I have a couple of questions. One, to just go back to telephone gap, sort of a two-part question, Tim. Were you surprised by at least this most recent decision from the National Forest Service? And two, where along the scale of like your biggest hope for the final plan and where this ended up? And then the follow-up is, so that's like a two-part question there. And then the other one is, do groups like Audubon Vermont and Coverts, do they go in front of and testify? Our local representative is a House representative is on the Forest and Ag Committee. And of course, they'll all be reconvening in January. Do groups like yours testify in front of committees like that? So if you can parcel all that together, you get an A.
I'll start with your most recent question, work my way back. You might have to remind me. But do we testify sometimes? Yes.
Yeah.
That is a role we play. From there, is there broadly anything I see missing or was hoping to see and don't see in this plan?
Yeah.
I believe that was your question.
Yeah.
The alternative that they've selected, from what I see and from the other documentation that I've seen from the Forest Service, really does honor the comments that Audubon Vermont and BNRC, Dr. William Keaton, submitted, you know, using his science and others to propose this triad approach to management. It really looks like it's captured in there. And I dare say from what I see, what I know, I'm happy with this.
Wow.
You know,
that's good news.
And then your first question, which was about the same line, can you remind me of your first question?
No, I think you've covered it in that sort of along the scale that this is as far as the activists, people that have worked on this, submitting more data, mm-hmm. getting the Forest Service to go back and revisit the forest that, they did that, and maybe we're seeing a change that will extend to other areas outside of Vermont.
Yeah, to put a fine point on it, we just are seeing much more of a prioritization of trying to emulate the natural processes using forestry, forest management, that really create these old forest conditions. And so we're trying to accelerate the restoration of these forests back to the way they were before we cut all the forests down. And that's what we need. And it's forest management is not a one-size-fits-all approach. It's very complicated, and it's my job and those of my colleagues and partners to communicate this and to explain it. I'm going to lean into that. I'm here to explain this and try to answer every people's questions. That's my job. But what I see here is the application of the most current research being developed, has been developed here in the East, and that's what we hope for.
Great. Henry?
Great. Yeah. I just want to say congratulations for moving this from what felt to me like a very intransigent national forest policy that, oh, well, we've figured this out. We don't need to figure it out again, mm-hmm. to going back and looking at it and being willing to, even though this is not a very big proportion of the, even the national forest in Vermont, it's a test case, and it's mm-hmm. moved it over the line. And I want to congratulate you for, everyone who worked on this for for having done it. I believe that forests really can have an impact excuse me, on climate change. And can offer some cooling even right now, quite separate of the whole carbon issue. And
I can't take too much credit. There's thousands of comments made, and there really is a rich network of partners that are all trying to figure this out together.
And I'm pretty familiar with a lot of those organizations you mentioned. It's an ongoing effort, you know, citizens showing up for rallies, but then having scientists really do the work. And, you know, it's sort of grassroots influence. It doesn't always just come from elected leaders. And I really appreciate you joining us today on GreenZine, Tim.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you both so much. It's great to talk to you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, Henry, we've left ourselves 9 minutes to go, which is a generous amount of time. I'm going to take just a moment here to highlight this book that I've just started reading a couple of chapters in. Once again, I will send the information along to Henry, and he can post it in the notes. The title of the book is What If We Get It Right? And it's written by Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson. And the subtitle is Visions of Climate Future. She probably has over 20 different interviews with well-known people like Bill McKibben, people from actually from the movie world. One of the directors of Don't Look Up is interviewed here. Media experts, scientists. There's a chapter which we won't get into today about the possible future of nuclear in the energy mix. But interspersed throughout the book are a couple of pages facing each other. One, 10 problems, and on the other side, 10 possibilities. So I went to the one of these sections, and I'm going to give you the 10 possibilities. We've been on a positive flow today, Henry, with the bird count coming up, with a report on telephone gaps. So we're going to keep it positive unless you want to drop a bummer bomb towards the end of the show. So here are 10 possibilities. These are solutions, and solutions are discussed quite a bit in this book from Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson. Protecting and restoring ecosystems could provide 37% of the CO2 mitigations needed to stabilize warming below 2 degrees centigrade by 2030. Mangroves and coastal wetlands can hold up to 5 times more carbon per hectare than tropical forests, reducing greenhouse gas pollution, ecosystem degradation, and biodiversity loss. And restoring land could have an estimated $140 trillion of benefit annually, and a third more than the entire 2023 global GDP. 16% of land area and growing has legal protections. The UN Convention on Biological Diversity goal is to protect 30% by 2030. Restoring 15% of croplands and pasture lands to natural ecosystems could prevent 60% of expected species extinctions and sequester almost 300 gigatons of CO2. Every dollar invested in restoring degraded forests can generate up to $30 in economic benefits. Species biodiversity and abundance are an average 10 to 15% greater, respectively, inside protected areas than outside of them. Improving farming practices, which we've talked about here quite a bit on the show, could reduce greenhouse gas pollution from ag by 10%. Every 1% increase in soil organic matter could sequester roughly 8.5 metric tons of atmospheric carbon and hold 20,000 more gallons of water per acre. Shifting to plant-based diets could reduce greenhouse gas pollution from ag by 80%. And finally, in reforestation, mixed species replantings hold 70% more carbon than monocultures. There's our positive spin from the book, What If We Get It Right?
Okay. So I have been tinkering with writing a letter to the editor, and
go for it.
And this is sort of negative, but not negative.
Okay.
And it's titled It's Time to Say Just Fix It. And I think what you've just laid out is exactly right. There are lots of avenues for fixing it, and there's a lot of fixes that aren't hard to do. We just have to do it. And I start this off with shame on the government, shame on corporations, shame on us personally. We have triggered the fifth great extinction. We are making the earth uninhabitable, and we're refusing to make changes that fix that. Record-breaking storms, floods, droughts, and wildfires are making ever larger portions of the U.S. Uninsurable and uninhabitable. The earth gets warmer each year, and the rate of warming gets greater each year. Even though we are increasing the usage of renewable energy, we have not decreased the use of fossil fuels. Emissions of all kinds of burning are costing us dearly, but there is no price tag attached to the activity. Demand systematic change of government, corporation, and ourselves. It is time to just say, fix it. And I think that really simple fix it message is, you know, I mean, this last election cycle, there was no discussion of this elephant in the room. It is something that we are just ignoring. And I think it's time to stamp a foot and say, fix it.
Yeah, and I think that threat. Yeah, and your 2 cents are very valuable, Henry. And I think you should draft that in. I will do spell check for you, by the way, and get that out to 7 days. Get that out to our local paper in this area, the White River Valley Herald. And I would also say send a copy down to the Valley News. So that sort of fix it, and there are solutions. And not to gloss over the problems, and you just named quite a few of them that have been going on for a really long time, is a more positive approach. And some of these are kind of already being done or could be ramped up to a larger scale. Some are scientifically possible and need to be implemented soon as far as cleaning things up and going forward with cleaner energy. So those type of, fix-it solutions, first of all, in one's personal lifestyle, family, community lifestyles, but also, of course, at the local town level, the state level, and at the national and international level. A lot of good points, Henry. I'm going to bring up a little music under. Still got a couple of minutes to go. This piece is from Paul McCandless, and it's called Winter Born. I'm going to go back to you in just a moment, Henry. I got a couple more tidbits. We might not get to them, but I do want to take time to acknowledge the underwriters for Green Zine each week. Heard 11 a.m. till noon, if you're catching us on the replay function. Wit and Grit up in Randolph, serving breakfast and lunch. The White River Land Collaborative, a unique project taking place in Tunbridge, just across the line from Royalton. Solar Fest, planning, it looks like that's going to be an early August weekend date for Solar Fest. We're getting more details on that week by week. The First Branch Coffee Company here in South Royalton, the Upper Pass Beer Company out of Tunbridge, Daniel Leibowitz, a longtime supporter at the radio station, Royal Trailworks Bale, who are helping out the White River Valley Herald with their nonprofit status, and finally, Soliflect. All right, Henry, you've got a minute to go. Got anything else for us?
Yeah, I think next week we will probably get into the fact that Vermont is spiraling down and building less and less solar when New York State and New Hampshire and the states around us are building more and more solar, and we got to fix that one too.
Yeah, and I think there will be some bills introduced in the upcoming session that try to bring back group net metering so that folks can, you know, have housetop or shared energy resources that don't necessarily take up as much real estate. So that's a great topic. I look forward to that. Henry, as always, good to hang with you here on the show.
Good to be here, and great to have you listeners out there paying attention. So appreciate it.
Right. Okay, we'll see you next. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Here on WFVR-LP, South Royalton, Vermont.